Howdy, Scott Linden here, host of the Upland Nation podcast. Glad you could join me today, tonight, whenever you're listening. Probably on the road somewhere. That's when I do most of my podcasting. Listening, I guess. We need to come up with a new verb for that. Anyway, hope your season isn't over yet. For most it is, but for some it's almost over. And that's not counting turkeys, but that's another subject for another day. Anyway, we're going to talk hunting around here. We're going to talk about sharing hunting spots and the ethics of doing that. The hows, the wheres, the whys, all of the above. And if you're interested in being a part of the discussion, you've probably already contributed something on Facebook, and I will be going there. But we'll also be talking about a place to go in warm weather this time of year if you're looking for something in the way of public access, a dog handling tip, and of course your own hunting reports from last weekend or the weekend before, whenever you went last. So we'll be dealing with all of that here on the Upland Nation podcast. First off, thank you, Mark, again for taking me to some great spots on the breaks of a wonderful river out here in the Pacific Northwest. Desert-like, we were up on the high spots, saw some elk, saw some deer. In fact, saw more elk than I've seen in a long time. Saw some deer, found a possible string of Indian rock hunting blinds. We don't know what else they might be. They could be just shelters, but a little of both, maybe. Maybe we're romanticizing that stuff, but that's the joy of going hunting. You never know what those really are, but I'm sure they've been used for many things over these centuries. And a few old homestead structures here and there, evidence of farming in eons past. Well, okay, decades past. Pretty cool spots, had a great time. All the birds were very nervous, most of them flying at 300 or 400 yards. The dogs are doing a good job, running hard, covering a lot of ground, getting a lot of good dog work at distance. But by the time we could get there, those birds were long gone, except for one covey on the second day, when we'd pretty much written it off because we could never get to these birds. But all of a sudden, Mark's beeper goes off, tells him his dog's on point at about 90 yards. We look, and there he is on the skyline. We can see the dog, and the ground is so bare, we can even see the birds. So we hustled, and about that time, Flick, who had been way off in the distance, and I'm thinking, great, all we need is a young dog coming in to make this one even more complicated. But he came over the rise, saw the other dog, saw us, probably saw the birds because he was upwind of them, hit the point, and there we had a pseudo back, and that's all I'm going to call it, while the birds got up, and hey, I hit one. And that's considering what I'm doing in the way of revising my shooting technique, that was a big one for me. I'm not going to belabor the point, but I told you I'm working on changing, going back to that instinctive style, and in this case, it sort of paid off. Mark was kind enough to give me full credit on the shot. I'll take it, Mark. I need all the wins I can get in the column this year, so thanks a bunch for that. Now, how about yourselves? Aaron Padgett dropped me a note. This time of year when people are making the transition from uplands to waterfowl down in Southern California, place that he loves, and had a good weather morning, but the real shooting picked up after the weather went south. 6 ducks, a couple green-winged teal, a cinnamon teal, gadwall, and 2 shovelers in the rain. Congratulations, Aaron. Good job. Glad to see that kind of thing happening. You're not the only one. Michael Gill was at Sovies Island, scratched out a few and some great dead bird finds, if you will. Not really dead, they were wounded. Okay, so duck search work by good dog, Ruger. Jeff Weiland, same thing. Willamette Valley, Oregon duck hunt. Here's a snowbound shot of a dog and who knows what else by David Sobolewski. That's where we're going to be next week, in the snow somewhere. Single rooster on CRP land in northeast Nebraska for Darren Timberlake. GSP puppy got her first romp in the field off the leash. I hope she came back. Quail hunt at Wing Haven Lodge for Jesse Byrne, and it looked like a real productive one. Beautiful dog, by the way. Let's see if we can get a close-up on that. Yeah, it looks like, it's kind of tough here, but it looks like it's probably a English setter. Same for Jeremy Slate Smith. Beautiful English setter. Looks almost all white. On a point on dry ground in the timber. Oh boy, do I love that. And then Ben Warner shows me once again one of those spots that I'm going to have to torture him into revealing at some point. Good girl, Bernie. Good girl. And a couple chuckers against the rocks there. Looks a little familiar, but they all do out there. Anybody else doing any shed hunting? George Cummins is doing some with his good dog, a Weimaraner, we call them spike antlers out here, maybe a little forked horn, hard to see from the picture. And then there's a beautiful backlit wire hair on the sagebrush sea somewhere. Scott Fuller, keep up the good work out there, my friend. Beautiful job, everybody. I hope you're still out there doing it. Or if you're not, you're thinking about working on the same things that I am. Shooting skills, for example, and maybe even some more training. Always room for more training. We'll be talking more about that down the road. We tend to neglect it. Once the season starts, all bets are off. If we only did just a little bit more, maybe we'd have a little bit more steady dog, or he'd do a little bit better on those dead bird searches, whatever it is. Maybe we'll do a segment on that sometime. All right. So anyway, the Upland Nation podcast is brought to you in part by Sage and Breaker Gun Care Products, crafted at the highest caliber. SageandBreaker.com. Always free shipping. Gift cards available. Yeah, maybe for Valentine's Day. It's coming right up. Consider maybe sending a link to that page to your special someone who you hope considers you special as well. And then another big word out, a shout out for my new resale site. It's called UplandNationDeals.com, and getting some great response there. Lots of folks coming on board, taking a look at the gear, and then offering up their own gear. It's kind of like Poshmark for guys like us. So if you have something to sell, easy to sell. You get paid fast because things move really fast. If you have something to buy, I say pro-level gear at entry-level prices. Go on the website and see for yourself. Need more collars. If you got an electric collar that you'd like to sell, you handle it all. I broker it. We handle all the heavy lifting, and you get the money faster that way. Free shipping for anybody who lists something for sale right now, limited time only. So get in on that. The sooner, the better. UplandNationDeals.com. Okay, without further ado, let me start out the discussion here with, just something for you to ponder. Think back on your entire bird hunting career, your dog training career, whatever else you're doing in our world in the uplands, and think about all the people you've interacted with. Okay, just bear that in mind for a moment as I make my case. None of us have been totally devoid of help from other people. It may not be obvious. It may not be overt. We may not have even asked for it outright, but we have received help of any number of sorts from the people around us, whether they're so-called Facebook friends or mentors, or somebody in your dog training club or at the shotgun range of one sort or another. We've all got help from somebody at some point. Some of that probably helps you find bird hunting spots. Some of that may be outright dropping a pin on an Onyx map, for example, and sending it to you. Or it might be, hey, go to this county in the northern part of that county, etc., etc. Anyway, you get the idea. If you are honest with yourself, and all you Facebook naysayers, I'm talking to you, if you're honest with yourself, somebody's helped you find another place to hunt birds. I was gonna call out somebody by name who seems to think he's a self-made bird hunter, and he's bad-mouthing a lot of other people who need some help for a whole bunch of reasons. And I'll be glad to elaborate on those as we get into this discussion a little bit more. But I can guarantee you, Andy, that somebody somewhere along the line took pity on you, perhaps because you needed that, or perhaps because you asked for help, or perhaps because they're just nice guys, and they helped you, Andy, find another spot to hunt birds. As I said, it may not have been the latitude and longitude, but they put you in a place so that you could see some success and then continue to be a hunter and a conservationist, and that's what it's all about. If we don't have more people coming into the hunting world, we're not going to have the money to manage the habitat or the wildlife. It's as simple as that. And that's my signal to quit gabbing and get to the phones. That be right about now. Welcome, Jared Baugh from Michigan. Let's talk about sharing spots and finding good spots and all those things. First off, how'd your season go? Or is it over yet?
Our season's been done here for we're done January 1st, so it's been a little bit.
Okay.
But we had a pretty good season. I mean, weather was kind of spotty, but it's just putting in boot leather and, you know, putting the time in. So that was a lot of it.
Do you hunt, since you're up in that general area, are you mainly a grouse hunter?
Yes, grouse and then pheasant when we can get into it, but there's not many pheasant left in Michigan. So, but primarily grouse and woodcock, yes.
Nice. So would you call your season, if you had to draw the line, would it be good or not so good?
Not so good. A lot of it was more logistics than anything else. So, but I mean, like I said, it's putting time in. So sometimes you put time in and you hope that things work out for you. And other times it's, hey, we can't believe how lucky we got. So it was a lot of hoping and putting time in, not so much getting in on them so much. So,
well, I can relate. For the last 2 years, I've made a promise to myself. I'm not going to hunt the same spot. I'm not going to hunt any spots I've hunted before.
Yep.
So the risk you run there is you cross a lot of those places off your list after you've been there.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's a lot of what this year was too, was trying to find new places. Just with so many people not working this past year, it was a lot of like, where else can I go? Not trying to burn the same spots over and over again.
You know, I never thought about it that way. You know, when this whole pandemic started and we were, you know, locked out, if you will, of public mm-hmm. ground for a while.
Yep.
But once our leads were unclipped, everybody was out there doing it. And
yes.
And we had, you know, more people in places than I've ever seen.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've heard that from a lot of people. I know a number of my friends are avid duck hunters, and people were just having a fit about how many people were out on the water. And I couldn't believe the number of deer hunters I saw. I mean, mm-hmm. just everybody was out doing something.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit in generalities about helping other people do what we do, which is try to find all those new spots. You know, how do we narrow it down, or how do we start? And you had some great suggestions. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about how you guys are doing it?
Sure. Up here in Michigan, they have a program called the Commercial Forest Program, and it's private property that is actually, it's a long-term agreement to manage it for logging, and they reduce the taxes on that. So allowing them to do that, the trade-off is you need to allow public access for hunters, and it's all walk-in properties, but these are all managed private properties that you have access to. It's almost like the hat properties and stuff like that out west that you guys have. So from there, you can log on the Michigan DNR website, and then you type in commercial forest land, or even if you just Google Michigan commercial forest lands, it'll pull up a map of the state, and it'll list counties. And then from there, you can click on the county, and it will pull up these PDF maps of properties that you have access to. So now you can say, oh, I can go here, and it'll give you roughly acreage or, you know, GPS coordinates, and say you can go here, you can go there, you can go here, you can go there. But they don't give you the ages of the cuts. So from there, we use an app called Scout and Hunt, which was created by, I want to say it was a forest manager. That gives you the ages of the cuts and the types of cover that is. So between the Scout and Hunt and the PDF maps, you can line up and say, okay, this is a 12-year-old cut, or that's a 25-year-old cut, or whatever. So you can kind of figure out where you want to go. But it's one of those things like not everybody knows about, and not a lot of people are like, oh, hey, here's where to find more covers at. So that will give you access to places that are not just common public lands, like, oh, the GEMS areas or the typical state land that we have available. But this is privately owned properties that are all walk and hunting only, but they have to be open to you. So you're more than welcome to go out there, put a dog down. And I've had quite a few successes stories using that. But then again, too, I've also been burned because you go up there and there's another car there and you're like, oh, I guess I'd find another one.
Well, let's talk about that a minute, because I've been in exactly that situation in several other states next door to you, but also out here in the West, it's the same way, you know, so you pull up to the parking place, and there's somebody else. What do you think is the right, in your opinion, what is the right thing to do at that moment when you discover another hunter already there?
Usually it depends. I take two approaches. Usually I'm saying here, one of them is if it's somebody there that is just unloading or just loading up, you know, usually kind of engage with them and see how they're doing. If it's somebody who's just stepping out, what their plan is, you know, have they hunted it before? You know, are they looking to put somebody else down? Is their dog fresh? Just kind of trying to almost buddy up like a lot of duck hunters do.
Yeah.
But if it's somebody out there, sometimes I'll stop and listen, because a lot of guys run bells on their dogs. So sometimes you can kind of gauge where they're at. Sometimes too, if it's a big property, I mean, some of these are rather large properties that they have available, you know, you just kind of go, well, here goes nothing. And you just kind of take your chances and walk it. And if you meet, I've met people out in the middle of the properties too, and you kind of have that conversation. Oh, how's your day been? You know, hitting any luck? And I always try to be accommodating as I can, but I'm not going to kowtow to anybody either. You know, I'm not going to be like, oh, well, I can't do that. But you kind of try to walk that line a little bit of being decent.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've had that payoff. Last week, I talked a little bit about that, how I pulled over to talk to a guy about what his plans were. And it turns out he had the keys to the kingdom. His farmyard was where the only real gate to the public property was. So we knock wood. We got lucky on that one. Now how about, let's just say, somebody wants some help finding a spot there. And let's just say they've been vetted by you in one way or another. They're your next door neighbor and you like them. Respect. It's a coworker you respect, or however they've qualified as within your inner circle, not just some schmo off the street. And they said, hey, Jared, I need some help here. I'm just learning this game. Can you give me a break? How far would you go to help someone like that? Where do you draw that line?
Usually I try to gauge their experience, because you get some people that are like avid duck hunters, or they're avid, deer hunters, and they're trying to get in on the game. And at that point, you know, you can kind of gauge them and say, okay, hey, you know what, I'm happy to help you. And at that point, usually I try to take them somewhere like some of the managed areas. Like, we have these GEMS areas that are specifically managed for grouse.
Yeah.
And you kind of help people get an education on that. Or if you talk to people and you kind of go, okay, you know kind of what you're looking for, but you're not having any success with it, then I try to go, okay, well, here's an area that you might want to go to over here. Or if you look on the map here, you're in the county, but there's three other places you could hunt it. And they may not know about those because they don't know about that commercial forest stuff. So I try to always gauge kind of where they're at with their experience. Cause like I said, you get some people that are, oh, I've always wanted a grouse hunt, but you know, it's been so many nice days and, you know, the ducks aren't flying. So I figure I'd throw some number eights in the gun and go take a walk. And I'm like, okay, well, come on, I'll give you a hand and we'll kind of get you out there and give some good experiences. See, it's more or less kind of case by case where you kind of gauge where they're at with things. There's a number of people that I know that haven't had success because they don't know what they're looking for.
Yeah.
Not a, you know, they've been walking. I've spent 2 or 3 years grouse hunting and all I've seen is, you know, my dog and, you know, and I'm like, well, you're hunting forest that's too old or you're not in the right stuff or stuff like that. So try to kind of help get them where they need to be.
I'm going to try and keep this positive because, you know, you go on some of the Facebook pages and it's just the opposite, but I think you know what I mean about all that. There are people out there who will never help anybody in any way ever. And,
absolutely.
And I know we're all going to draw our line in a different spot. These people, well, we'll talk more about that as we get into the Upland Nation podcast even more. But Jared, your advice is well thought out and helpful, and a lot of it is stuff that, you know, just a few tips here and there is going to get somebody off doing their own research and, in effect, earning their birds. But they do need, I mean, everybody, we didn't learn to drive a car by ourselves. We didn't learn to type, or we didn't learn to frame a house just by looking at Facebook pages and figuring out where everybody else is framing houses.
Exactly. You know,
that's my point. Jared, you've put it together way more eloquently than me. Thank you so much for being a part of the Upland Nation podcast.
Absolutely. I'm glad I can help. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye. And next on the line, Brandon Murphy. Brandon, where are you calling from?
Calling from Southern Illinois.
Okay, so let's just pretend you're some guy I met in the local tavern. And where exactly in Southern Illinois are you? Because I'd like to hunt right there.
I'm actually in Trenton, Illinois. We're about 30, 35 minutes to the east of St. Louis, Missouri.
Okay, I know that country. You're not too far from SIU. And great school, alumnus of that school, and actually two now that I think about it. But anyway, so somebody confronts you like that and says, "Oh, you're a bird hunter. I'd love to bird hunt a little bit more. Tell me where to go."
Well, I mean, it seems like the one common denominator in the kind of the Midwest is CRP. You know, you get the tall grasses. It's good cover for the birds. You know, the other thing that along with the CRP that I look for that I've kind of just figured out through trial and error is if you've got some water near it, either a pond or a stream or something like that, or some low, has some low spots that gathers, you know, dew and stuff. And then the last is feed. If you've got that trifecta there with, you know, maybe a cut corn field or a bean field or, you know, some kind of berry trees and stuff like that. That seems to be the, you know, if I can look on a map and find that trifecta, I know I'm going to be, I stand a pretty good chance.
And that is most helpful information that a lot of people just won't get because they're brand new. We want them to be successful. They want to be successful. Okay. So if I'm in the break room and we're both pouring a cup of coffee and we're going to sit down at the table in there for a couple minutes, would, depending on how well you knew me or what I asked, would you go any further than that to help somebody find a good hunting spot?
I mean, I would. And, you know, I feel that's kind of what makes bird hunting different is I feel like bird hunters are more open to sharing spots where they want to hunt as opposed to deer hunting. It's like they'll tell you, but it's probably 200 miles away from where they're actually hunting.
Yeah, it's like fly fishers. Every lake has a funny name and every stream is the same, you know.
Exactly.
Well,
exactly.
So and you know, tell me what you're comfortable telling me, but is there ever a time where you would draw the line and say, okay, listen, I'm going to tell you what this much, but I'm not going to tell you that much?
I can't say that I would say that just for the simple fact that it's just something that's enjoyable. And if we as, you know, hunters and trying to make it fun for beginning and hunters that are trying to experience it, you want them to have success. And if they don't have success, you know, hopefully people would stick with it, but you never know if you got that fringe hunter. And so I, like I said, I've never had anybody like really like, no. You know, I've had gentlemen that are twice my age that are like, yeah, you know, yesterday I was in this field and I hit up, you know, a couple coveys of quail here and over here in this field. You know, it was about a 2.5 mile drive. You know, there was some good cover and we saw good pheasants. And so it just seems like everybody that I've come across has been overly helpful, and I appreciate it. And I think it's, you know, kind of my duty to pass it along.
You know, it's funny because you just made me flash on something, because I've had the same thing happen. I've been a bird hunter for 30 years. So I'm that guy you were just talking about. And I'm always willing to share. Sometimes I don't share everything with everybody, but that's another story. I'll get to that later. But I've seldom had somebody be outright, be an asshole about this. There are people out there, and it's interesting how many of them are on Facebook. But I've never experienced it personally. And I wonder if it's certainly not because I'm such a nice guy. You know, if you know me at all, you probably ought to be an asshole to me, but what is the principal reason? So you can you think of any reason somebody would not want to share a spot?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, maybe perhaps if it's private ground, you know, in Illinois, bird hunt a lot of private ground. And, you know, our numbers, especially down in southern Illinois, aren't great. And so I would just think somebody wouldn't want somebody coming in traipsing on private ground. And, you know, maybe it's late season and, you know, you're trying to get those last few birds, and maybe you wouldn't share if, you know, I know how the roosters are. They don't like to hold tight in late season. They're ready to go. But if you found a spot that maybe you're lucky enough to get them to hold tight, maybe people would kind of hold that back, you know, trying to kind of finish off their season. I mean, those are possibly reasons that I could think of.
I get them all, especially the private thing. I was invited a couple weekends ago to go to a place that it was actually in our state's walk-in program, so it was obviously on private property. And this guy said, listen, I'll take you there. I'll show you how to get to it and all of that, but you can't take anybody else. And you can't talk about it on the podcast. And Felton, I have not done either one of those things, and I promise I won't. But that was the deal we made before we went any further. And that, maybe that's one of the things that will come out of this. We need to be upfront. Everybody needs to be upfront about what the rules are before they, you know, go any further. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that down later in the podcast as well, because I had an experience, speaking of Felton, while we were getting ready to leave for one of our hunting spots. And it was awkward, to say the least. But you would, let's say you don't want them going in on the last pheasant of the season. Mm-hmm. Would you send them somewhere else?
I mean, I would. And this, from my experience, we had a great hunting trip. My cousin and I and a couple other guys did some Kansas and Nebraska walk-in. We wanted to do completely all walk-in. And we were lucky enough to do a little bit of private. We saw some roosters run into a field, but you know, like you said, at the local tavern, when we were struggling a little bit in some spots, we went to a different spot in Kansas. And, one of the guys, actually a couple, and the gentleman's dad had been hunting there for years. And, you know, they kind of gave us some ideas, and they said, if you see, and this is what I put on my Facebook post, if you see plum thickets near a road stop, that's going to have quail. And like 7 out of 10 plum thickets that we saw along the road that were walk-in, we'd get out and boom, our dogs immediately went on point and we got into quail. And it's just little tips like that. You know, you can give somebody a suggestion like that, but not exactly point out to a spot on a map, you know, to kind of get them started in the right direction.
You know, I wish people would have to wear a badge that says, I'm a butthead. or I'm a nice guy, and vice versa. But that, you know, that's the kind of stuff that we're trying to do all the time. We're trying to help other people with this sport for a whole bunch of reasons. And that's a great example. By the way, I had a very similar example a couple seasons ago in Kansas. We were mobilizing, and before the cameras were even turned on, my dog was on point in a plum thicket right next to the road. So, yeah, that's a good one. Keep that one in your front pocket forever.
Absolutely.
Hey, so how was your season?
You know, it's been great. I can't complain. You know, actually, when we got into more central and northern Illinois, we actually got into quite a few pheasants this year, which was in Illinois, which is very optimistic, which is awesome. And, you know, I hunted some private ground down around me. A friend of mine that took over his grandfather's farm, you know, dove hunting this fall, we kicked up several covey of quail. And so, you know, when the season opened for upland birds in Illinois, you know, that was one of the first place we hit up and had a bunch of success with quail there. And, you know, I got out to Kansas in my first trip to Nebraska and had a great time out there, you know, and got into my first prairie chicken ever. So that was very cool. And it's been a great year. I can't complain.
Oh, you're getting me excited now. We got to, if we count Nevada down just south of me, we got another week and a half left. So I'm looking forward to tromping around in the snow down there to finish out our season. Well, thanks a lot. It's always good to talk with anybody from that part of the country. I'm glad you're having a good time. Brandon Murphy, thanks for being a part of the Upland Nation podcast.
Thanks so much, Scott.
Yeah, you know, if you, quid pro quo comes to mind, if you know what that means, tit for tat, this for that, whatever you want to call it. You know, the people who don't get any help from their fellow hunters perhaps deserve it. Maybe they, possibly because they don't understand the etiquette, the protocol involved. They don't understand where we draw our lines. But maybe because they're just outright undeserving of help. I mentioned one person earlier in the podcast who probably never does get any help from anybody. Might be the rare exception to that rule, and I can understand why. He's a jerk. But other than that, most people are pretty darn nice. And if we're nice back to them, and there's a trade out of some sort or another, and it can't, you know, it's everything from buying a beer for the guy next to you in the tavern to helping with cleanup or dog training or setting up for a club event. All of those things end up in your arsenal of good deeds, and eventually another good person will recognize that and, if nothing else, take pity on you. And I'm Scott Linden, your host. Thank you for sticking with us here at the Upland Nation podcast. We are talking about, you know, the protocol, the etiquette of sharing spots or giving advice, even for that matter. Man, I've been to a few trap clubs where the guy next to you doesn't even want to look at you, let alone help you in some way. But on the line with me is Glenn Ainsworth. Glenn, whereabouts are you in our fair state?
I'm in Ontario.
Well, that's a good place to be if you own a few shotguns and a bird dog. You know, until everything got crazy, were you having much of a bird hunting season?
Well, not like I have.
Yeah.
Pheasants are down over here on ground that I've been hunting, so I'm looking for new ground. And the chuckers have actually been phenomenal the times I was able to get out and go after them. Elk season put a little hamper in the middle of that chucker season, but
yeah, well, that's it. Yeah, we all have our crosses to bear.
Yeah, I was extremely shocked at some of the chucker numbers I saw in the places I've been to.
And where are those places?
Well, I tell you what, you want to come next year, we'll go to a couple of them and see if they're still there.
I'd love that, and I be careful. I might take you up on that, and we have witnesses now. But that leads us into this whole idea of, let's just say we don't know each other. Pardon me. There. We don't know each other very well. We correspond a little bit online, but that's about it. But here, yep. Here I am, and I'm just some guy. And now you tell me the chukar hunting's pretty good out there. Okay, so how far are you willing to go to help me find some chukar hunting out there?
Well, if you had a paper map, I could put you in the general vicinity.
Yeah.
The minute exploration would be on your own.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, there's places I've gone that in the last few years were really... Of course, that Snowmageddon we had 4 years ago really put a number on our chukar population in the Mauhi River.
Oh, yeah.
And the Owyhees and Cottonwood area over in Mauhi County hard. I mean, we had upwards of 6 feet of snow over here. And that does not induce good numbers for any animal.
But since then, and we've both been there, literally been there this season, we've seen the populations come back to a great degree. And you're helping me here because you've just kind of drawn a circle, and the circle's pretty big. But in your case, with somebody who seems to be a nice guy, you're willing to share at least, you know, to go to this county or that county and look for something beyond that. Is there a kind of a tip for once we get to a place that you would suggest we do, whether it's, well, look where all the cars are parked and go somewhere else, or look for this kind of habitat? What else would you be willing to help somebody with?
Well, you've got, of course, you get up to the high ridges, if there's water available, you've got little... there's water in them rocks if it just recently rained. So you're not going to have to concentrate on springs and drainages and little reservoirs where if it's been hot and dry, like usually the first of the season always is, you're going to have to concentrate around water. And later on the season, after we get some moisture, you want to stay on the south slopes. Those birds will concentrate on them, the southern ridges that get the exposure, the heat up. I've had, was shocked at bumping two coveys of chuckers on the same ridge and walked down to the glass flat to get like a saddle and went up the other one and bumped huns. And I'm like, ooh, holy cow. I've never seen huns out here before. I've been hunting that area since I was a young kid. My grandpa took me out. And I basically hunt where my grandpa hunted. And I have 40 years of, just remembering where grandpa went.
You're lucky.
Helped me a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. You're lucky you had a mentor or perhaps more than one. And that's, what I think a lot of people are looking for. And maybe they don't know how to ask quite as clearly or as circumspectly, if I can coin a term, but they do want help and they want to be helpful as well. So, yeah. And you're right. It's been a fascinating year for Hungarian partridge out that country. I know I have seen more in the last two seasons than I've seen in the last 10 seasons. So something's out there. Maybe it's the water. I don't know. Glenn.
Yeah, I was shocked at the chukar numbers this year. That's for sure. Yeah. Over the last couple of years.
Well, I'm glad for you, and let's hope a lot of them survive this winter and spring.
Yeah. Well, you got a good winter going right now. Hopefully, the spring doesn't dump on us.
Yeah,
that's
I don't.
Not good for bird numbers either.
Yeah, so if you're a cow man or an alfalfa guy, you really hate this winter so far. But if you're a hunter, you're loving it. So listen, good to talk with you. Thanks for being a part of the Upland Nation podcast, Glenn.
Yep. Anytime.
All right.
Appreciate it. Love your show.
Thank you. And I love my show too. I love talking with you folks about this kind of stuff. The Upland Nation podcast is brought to you in part by Dr. Tim's Performance Dog Food. Write it down or just go to your Googleizer right now, drtims.com, drtims.com. this time of year, it's, you know, maybe you're thinking about investing in some new gear, places, some research. We're all shopping for a new shotgun because they'll undoubtedly help us shoot straighter. But maybe it's time to rebuild your dog with superior nutrition. Settle back, take a breath or two, and decide whether your dog might actually be able to perform even better next year. Of course, they're all super dogs in the off season, but maybe a little bit more mileage, maybe a few more days. It all depends on what he eats. Look to the ingredients, their quality, where they come from. Learn all of that stuff at drtims.com. And don't forget, 30% discount on your first order. Use the code UPLANDNATION. Thanks a lot, and tell Dr. Tim Hunt that you heard about it on the Upland Nation podcast. Quick reminder, uplandnationdeals.com. I mentioned upgrading your gear if you're going to do that. How about the first opportunity you have to basically, in effect, trade in your old gear and fund your new gear with it? That's what happens at uplandnationdeals.com. Sell your old stuff, if it's lightly used and brand name and the good stuff, and buy the new stuff or the almost new stuff, you know, and let somebody else, in effect, take the depreciation. UplandNationDeals.com. Learn all about getting pro-level gear at entry-level prices and getting shed of the stuff that you don't need anymore and helping some other people get involved in our sport, unless you're Andy. If you're Andy, you don't want anybody else involved. But the rest of us, we do. Thanks a lot. Hey, we got a lot more coming up. In fact, stand by because I already see Dominic on the line. So hold on for that. And it looks like somebody else after that and a whole bunch of other things in that arena. But first things first. Our Handle It segment, brought to you by Happy Jack Dog Care Remedies. Yeah, I use them on my dog. No, I'm not that dumb. I just sound that dumb. Here's your tip this week, something I learned the hard way. Maybe you did too. You can relate to this, and maybe the rest of you won't have to learn it the hard way as a result. You've heard the term fight fire with fire. Oh, that's great, except when it comes to your dogs. You know, a lot of times dogs are nervous, anxious, curious, protective. You know, when the UPS guy pulls into the driveway, they're barking and jumping, running in circles, which is probably not what you want. Heck, in my house, even when I lace on a pair of boots, Flick gets excited. So, you know, what do we usually do? Our default response is yell back, get high energy in the way of a response, which really just amps up the dog even more. That all translates to your training situations and your behavior in the field. So if you're like me, maybe you ought to just dial things down a little bit. If my dog is jumping up and barking, I'm going to help him relax a little with behavior that sounds like this. You get a dog on point. Maybe he doesn't need the, you know, the gung-ho football game kind of excitement. He needs just the opposite. Don't yell. Dial it down. Maybe your dog will respond the right way to your cool, calm, collected behavior. Okay, if I didn't put you to sleep, welcome back to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. Let's get back to the discussion about sharing spots and why and how. And let me give you one perfect example. The right way, but first the wrong way. So I alluded to Felton taking me to some spots that he had discovered and worked hard at finding and exploring. He brought me along. And so at the end of the first day, we were loading dogs into the hotel rooms and relaxing. It was obvious what we were there for. And across the courtyard, if you will, were a couple guys drinking beers, which looked really good, and cooking something on their little barbecue, which smelled really good. And we said hello and they said hello and that was that. We took care of the dogs, et cetera, et cetera. The next morning, we're putting dogs into the trucks and out comes one of those guys and races up and just says, "Hey, I'd like to go hunting with you." So we look at each other just like on TV, you know, that double take that everybody makes. We don't even know the guy's name. And here he is asking to share our dogs, share our spots, and share our time and our company when we don't know whether he's a serial killer or just a butthead. Oh, I mentioned that. Sorry, Andy. I'm going to leave that for you from now on. Anyway, we hemmed and hawed and basically said, "Nah, we don't even know each other well enough yet. So, maybe some other time." If I was going to rewrite that script, the night before it would have started with, "Hey, I see you guys are some hunters. Have a beer. Tell me all about it. What are you doing for supper?" Etc., etc., etc. And by the end of all of that, maybe we would have a better, more comprehensive feel for who this guy was and what he really was about. I've talked a couple times already about earning your birds and earning your invitations, if you will, your mentorship. It is a quid pro quo, something for something. And hold on, Dominic. Yeah, I know that's you, and I'm on my way right now. So maybe I'll get more into this after we talk to our next caller. So hang loose and let's talk to Dominic. So Dominic, where are you today?
I'm in secret spot Arizona right now, actually.
Yeah.
But we were hunting north of Phoenix this weekend, and it's been rain, snow, sleet, hail, and mud, which is kind of unusual for quail hunting in Arizona.
Well, that's why everybody wants to go there this time of year, is to avoid all of those things you just rattled off.
Yeah.
It's too bad for you. Did you get any decent hunting in before all the weather dumped on you?
I haven't yet, but I'm here until the end of the season, so it should be definitely. It's a good year for desert quail, not such a great year for Mearns quail this year, so I'm focusing on chasing desert quail.
As well you should, and you are eminently qualified to know how to do that. You are a biologist with some experience in all of those areas. We're going to talk about that. You're also deep into the breeding thing these days, aren't you?
Yeah, in fact, you know, Dad and I started bred our first wire hair in 1997, so we've been doing it for a while.
And other than being basically rained and snowed out over there, how's the rest of your season been going?
It's been kind of a different season. My life is changing as I get more and more dogs, and you end up running younger dogs and taking out lots of people who buy puppies from you and co-owners and different things. And so it's been not as many piles of birds, but great experiences this whole season. I spent some time hunting in Idaho, Washington, Montana, most of my hunting right around Oregon, and I was also guiding at Highland Hills for about a month and a half before COVID shut that down. So been getting out a lot this fall.
Well, good for you, and glad to hear it. So when we started this discussion, you said you're in a secret spot in Arizona, and that's perfect lead-in to this whole discussion about finding places to hunt. There's, you know, two dimensions at least to that. There's probably 100 dimensions now that I think about it. But one is, okay, let's learn habitat and bird behavior. And we all do that every day. And then there's, at some point you have to put an X on a map and go to that place. And so I'd like to start with that. But I don't want to neglect the other side, the biological side, because you do have such a unique perspective. So how much would you tell a good friend about where you are right now?
Because I'm not like an Arizona guy, I would literally send you a pin of where you could find Gamble's quail. And we did I mean, every place, honestly, that I thought looked somewhat decent or that had a guzzler nearby, there was either fresh shotgun shells or a truck with dog boxes in the back. I mean, it's this late in the season. There's almost nothing else left to hunt, and so a lot of guys are coming down here to Arizona, snowbirding their way down here. So it's pretty popular. I don't think there's a lot of secrets to some of the real obvious spots, but there's an enormous amount. I mean, you could literally from Phoenix, you could drive for 3.5 hours in almost any direction and get out of the truck and find a Gamble's Quail. So, I mean, it's pretty vast and there's tons of public land.
Would you, I mean, if I was just some guy you met in the Walmart, and saw you wearing Blaze Orange, or I saw your dog boxes out in the parking lot, and I said, "Hey, man, where should I go hunting?" Would your answer be different?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think I just try to give real generalizations of like, I mean, Wickenburg as opposed to saying like a mountain range, and then just say, you can go on Arizona Game and Fish and download the app and look at the guzzlers the same as everyone else. You can, I would look for water in the early season, and after it rains a bunch, they're going to be spread way out in the desert and could be just about anywhere. But I always start on the washes in the morning. If I don't find them down low, head up to the hills. That's what I would tell you if you were in Walmart.
Okay, so you would be helpful. You wouldn't say, "Go earn your own spots, butthead." Oh, wait, sorry, that's Andy's line. You had to be there, Dominic. Anyway, so in the past, and I'm going to relate a couple more of my stories as we go, but in the past, have other people helped you in one or the other of those types of ways over the years?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. A lot of, say, retired hunters or old timers, or I mean, for me, in this world of NAVDA, North American Versatile Hunting Dog Association, I ran my first dog in NAVDA when I was 18, and so I've been real involved in those. And I meet people all the time that give me outrageously good spots that they honestly shouldn't, because I'm gonna go hunt there, and I probably have a pile of dogs and somebody else with me, but so yeah, I mean, I've also done a ton of horse trading. I give you a spot, you give me a spot, I take you hunting, you take me hunting. But I think communication is part of my skill set of like, you can't come back to this spot. Like, this is my secret spot. Or sure, come back here, just don't take everybody and their brother sort of thing. You want to communicate that.
You make a good point, and I agree with all of that. And then here's the rub. Okay, so 2 weeks later, you go to that spot after I've promised never to bring anybody else, and there I am with three of my buddies. This
Well,
is the problem. How do we deal with
yeah.
that?
Well, the same way that people talk about dealing with wolves, you shoot, shovel, and shut up, and just make all those vehicles disappear. The bodies are out in the desert; should be no problem,
Okay. Our kids, don't try that at home, by the way. He's making a joke.
No, I think that it has happened to me, and I like everyone has been mega burned over the years, and have had people honestly go back to the same spot the very next day. Especially, I really got into waterfowl hunting for a long time and hunting Northern California where it was like public land, and I figured out some little secret niches where it was like this pond would never have birds on it, but if you set up there, you can, kind of run traffic and it works, but you would never think to go there because it's 80 yards from the parking lot. But once you show someone that trick and then they show their buddy and their other buddy, then that spot is done. And I had that happen to me way too many times.
So it re I mean, but it hasn't soured you on doing it for people who, as you described, are willing to horse trade or are nice people or they have something they're willing to contribute to the transaction, if you will.
Yeah, well, I'm in it for the long game, and
Yeah.
my biggest goals have been, this R3 recruitment, retention, reactivation. That's I've been taking out kids since I was a kid, and I've been now, the one of the greatest angles, taking lots of first time hunters, new hunters, hunters from the city, hipster hunters, women hunters, you know, they're all hunters to me, but taking out a ton of people that really, that are never going to be kind of the crazy hardcore bird hunters that maybe are like my dad was, but they're the future. So I'm all for helping folks out. I'm certainly not giving out free pins on the internet, but I mean, I'd like to talk. I mean, I'm happy to give your listeners some really good ideas of how to do scouting digitally and non-digitally to find new spots.
Well, let's go to that. And again, your perspective is different because you are a biologist and you're in the field a lot. Why don't you give us a little background first off?
Yeah, so... Well, I grew up, my dad was also a biologist manager in one of the most heavily hunted public wildlife areas in Utah, right on the edge of the Great Salt Lake. Pheasants, quail, snipe, tons of waterfowl hunting at Ogden Bay and a bunch of other wildlife areas he managed. And so that's kind of my background, is growing up on a very heavily hunted wildlife area. And then I spent 16 years in California as a coastal goose biologist, a crane biologist, a waterfowl biologist, and many years in Washington as sage grouse and among other types of biology work that I did. And then National Wild Turkey Federation in Idaho, Washington, and Oregon as a turkey biologist. And then now I actually am a wetland biologist at the Malheur Refuge. I work for a nonprofit where I work just specifically in Harney County, working on wetland habitat, bird habitat. So those are sort of my backgrounds. On top of that, being, you know, dog breeder and bird hunter from, you know, Mexico to Canada in the West anyways. So lots of experience. Someone just asked me this the other day, like, what is your favorite part about hunting? And it's a really hard thing to answer, but I would say for me, it's always the same. It's going to new places. I don't go to the same camp every year, year after year after year. I go to new places. So I'm always the guy who's having to learn something new.
Yeah, well, welcome to my world. And it's a wonderful world. I'm the same way. In someday we'll have a podcast discussion about body piles on tailgates, but that's not for today. But some people consider success, a limit. Some people consider nobody getting shot as a successful day in the field. Others go for the dog work, which, of course, trips my trigger. But also finding new places, whether we bring home a big bag or a small bag or no bag at all. Sounds like you and I might get along really well. So where are we going to meet next?
Yeah. Well, I'm in the best spot near you. Yeah. County is a great spot to live. So let me just dive into this.
Yeah.
Bit.
Go.
So I would say the non-digital side of finding new spots is getting less and less, but there's still some of it out there. I mean, I still everybody from, you know, I'm 40, but everybody my age and older started out with books and atlases and fold-up maps. And I still have thousands of those, which I actually need to start getting rid of. But I mean, those Wilderness Press books that were like, how, you know, bird hunting in each state, Arizona, Oregon, whatever, like that was a great starting place. If you look through them now, there's some better resources out there, but that was a great way to start. My dad saved 25 years of the Audubon Christmas Bird Count magazine, and would, you know, have highlighted year after year where quail numbers were in every city. He was a big time quail hunter. And so there is old ways of sort of thinking outside the box. Go into your library and just looking at old books about bird hunting can actually give you some ideas. Like I already mentioned, some great ideas of talking to old timers, meeting people at a dog trial, like those kind of things. Now, the other thing that I think that I wanted to talk to you from my biologist perspective is the idea of like calling a local biologist or warden. And I'm sure you've probably had some mixed experiences with that, I would guess.
I'm not the only one. I'd say generally speaking, 50-50. So about half the people we contact, I contact, whether it's to make TV shows or just to go hunting, are incredibly good people. The other half are not. so incredibly good.
Yeah. Well, I think I could give some insight on that for somebody who's been on the other end of that phone a ton in my life. Sort of what maybe not to do and maybe some ideas about things, ways to talk to
Great.
The right person. I mean, I felt like, you know, I spent almost 10 years as a waterfowl biologist in Northeastern California, and about, you know, 3 days before opening day, this is what every phone call that buzzes to your desk is like, oh, hey, this is Jimbo. My dad was like the DU chairman of XYZ town for 20 years, and I'm bringing my kids up and I don't have time to scout on Friday, and I don't want to walk very far, and I don't want to bring very many decoys, and we just want a nice hunt that we can mostly shoot greenheads. And you're kind of like, you know, and you try to help these people out, but it's not exactly the best method. And I'll talk to you about some good ways to do that. So I would say, like, the first step in figuring this out, and this is what I have to go through too, is figuring out the right person to talk to. Because I mean, I you'd be shocked how often you can call, say, a fish and game office, and literally the front desk person who may have never hunted, never even knows the difference between a bird, is the one who's giving you the intel on where to go. So you need to make sure you're finding the right person, whether it's the biologist, whether it's a warden, whether it's even like a statewide person, you know, that's the waterfowl coordinator. And you kind of got to ask the right questions as far as, like, you know, oh, so do you hunt yourself? Or, you know, what is, you know, how often are you out in the field? Like, where, you know, asking these right kind of questions, and making sure that it's not like the guy who just moved here from Kansas 2 months ago, you know, to wherever you're calling. So make sure you've got the local that is the right intel. And those people can be hard to find, but a little bit of fishing around. I would say what will really help you with that is not waiting the week before your hunt, when, especially in the fall, like, all biologists are mostly getting big game hunters, just big game, big game, big game, big game. And they're just sure. overwhelmed talking to people. And so start off months and months and months ahead of time and figuring out who this right person is, build rapport with them, whether it's the biologist or often the wardens, or can be really good because they're out driving around a lot. And you've got to ask these right questions. You know, you've got to ask the questions of, you know, how are the bird populations this year compared to last year? How are they compared to overall? You know, have you been seeing big broods? What areas, you know, and you kind of have to build up to this. Like, I have some contacts in Montana that, you know, you talk to them year after year after year, and you can tell you're not getting the general spiel anymore. You're actually getting a little bit more information that's saying, well, Huns are really down, except for on this block management, I saw a ton of them. And you know they're not telling everybody that, most likely.
No, in fact, where was that block management?
Yeah, I think it's 123.
Yeah, yeah. By the way, there's like 122 total in Montana, probably.
But, so just asking the right questions, being persistent, and then kind of being around in Oregon, Washington, you know, with the Master Hunter program, whether you're part of OHA or some sort of hunter volunteer group. A lot of times the biologists and the wardens are working with those people in the summertime. And that is a really good, like, if you can make a better connection with that person, you're going to sound so much better than, like I talked about earlier, the guy who calls the night before opening day.
Yeah. You know, you, by the way, this is the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. That's Dominic Bachman, currently, probably drying out in Arizona. But also a neighbor, if I stand up and lean to the left, I can probably see your place out there. I heard you moved. I know exactly where you are now. And someday I'll come visit. But anyway, you know, you're saying things that we've been saying throughout the podcast that I'm going to describe as kind of vetting yourself and vetting the people to whom you're asking questions and expecting favors from. I'm just a music major, so I can use that bad English. But is it important to basically offer something in return for something?
Well, I feel, and I know you've had bad experience because everyone has, and they tell me about it, but I feel that it's really my job. Like, when I when I worked at, for example, Modoc National Wildlife Refuge, if people called and asked if the hunting was good or bad, I mean, depending on the, if they asked the right questions, I would say, well, the bird averages 1.1 ducks, you know, but I went out and shot, you know, me and the boss went out and we shot 14, you know, and so we shot our limits. And so I do feel it's my job, it's my role. I'm happy to tell you guys whether, you know, tell the hunters it's a good year, it's a bad year. I know some state agencies are kind of more at like this midline where they're supposed to say, they kind of given them a company line that they're supposed to basically say, well, it's a little spotty here and there, but if you get into the right locations, they can be pretty good. I mean, that's what Montana says every year when it's having a really bad year. You'll get that from person after person and you can kind of tell. But as far as that tit for tat, I do feel like with the private lands, absolutely. One of my best techniques is if you like a spot in public land and you're trying to expand your spot, the private land right next to it, whether this is chukar hunting or bird hunting of any kind, you want to target those spots and ask for permission on those spots. And I'm a big believer. I lived on the coast for a long time. Things like salmon, halibut, crab, you show up with a milk crate of that, and that can open some doors. I think everyone knows that, but it's also about the timing. Just like talking to a biologist, your timing needs to be early in the season. You don't want to show up wearing camo on opening day, right?
Yeah, and in fact, a lot of those people who may be the recipient of your largesse might be running a combine until 11 o'clock at night that time of year. And so you probably do want to be a little bit more strategic about things like that.
Yeah. And I've had, this is so the strategies that I would say, well, this is private landowners. And this is, I think this fits in with the podcast kind of, it's about getting new spots, is that for me, my best strategies is using building that rapport by starting with, okay, we're only letting kids hunt, or we start by, oh, we're interested in hunting coyotes, or especially like rabbits. Kids hunting rabbits have gotten us on hundreds of properties that now we've made we've built rapport with these properties, and now we're allowed to bird hunt on them. But it started by kids hunting rabbits. And so, and it started by asking in June, not in September. So those kind of situations can go a long ways for you.
Let's go back to the analogy I've been using all podcast, which by the way is called the Upland Nation, and that's Dominic Bachman, and I'm Scott Linden. The guy on the bar stool next to you, wearing blaze orange, and clearly had a good day in the field. What would you do to get a little closer to better hunting with a guy like that night in that tavern?
How would I help him?
How would you help him in a way that would also ultimately help you?
Ah, I see. So like we did talk about some of the ideas of trading, but I will say something that a couple of examples of, I've met people that I thought didn't seem very bright, and I thought I was maybe could be a smarter hunter than them. And it turns out sometimes hunting doesn't need to be as complex as a biologist tries to make it out to be. I know a guy who hunts here in Arizona that his tactic for hunting deer was literally to drive along until he saw a deer crossing sign and start hunting in that area, which seems ridiculous, but he was very successful.
Yeah, well, and they can't read.
Well, along those lines, though, the same with you know, you're hunting in the Snake River for waterfowl, and there's a blind that sticks out really obvious at this one point of the island, and you think, I'm not going to hunt there. Everyone hunts there. I'm going to hunt the other side. And you set up on the other side, and all the ducks come into that spot, and somebody else has figured this out for you. So sometimes, I mean, I keep track when I'm bird hunting. We can talk a lot about OnX, but I mean, I keep track of when I see another truck with dog boxes, I mark it as a spot. I don't know anything. I don't know if it's good. I don't know if it's bad, but I mark it. and I put down special notes that says other bird hunter, so I know what that is. But I have found some pretty amazing spots by hearing a lot of gunshots in places, quote unquote, as a biologist, I would never waste my time on.
You know, this is gold, Dominic, because these are things we really don't think about very often, but are right up there with looking at a satellite image. They are as useful, if not more useful than that. And that's not even considering whether you're going to buy the guy next to you a beer or not, because I've seen that happen. I was reminded of that again last night in a different situation. But there are certain commonalities, and I wrote about this a while back, and one of them is having an appropriate attitude, going into all these situations with a little bit of humility. And you mentioned people who may not be as smart as you or certainly smarter than me, whichever it is, but not assuming anything about who's higher on the totem pole, and then open-mindedness and a willingness to, in effect, as I've said, earn some sort of access to information or even better to a piece of property. Are there any other more universal characteristics that we should use, whether it's dealing with a game warden on the phone or a biologist in the field or whatever else, that are tried and true for you?
Well, I don't know if this is exactly getting at what you're asking, but I would say there's something to do with sort of being in the club. So whether it's a private landowner, you make one friend that's a rancher in an area or a farmer, and he has this ultimate network of connections, and you have connected with him, and he connects you with his buddy or the land that he leases, and it just grows from there. And I feel like the same can be if you get a warden who's like always helped you with your sharp tail spots, or whatever. And you say, hey, we're wanting to go to Wyoming this year. And he says, oh, I have a buddy down there that's a warden. Like, that level of connection is worth a ton, as you probably know, especially that, with a private landowner who's in the club, or like getting to know a biologist or warden or someone who works in the agency that will make sure you're talking to the right person and kind of give that little introduction.
Yeah.
Like, hey, this is just some guy that has a podcast, or hey, this is my friend, and he is really just looking for a place to go kill a couple of birds over his dog. And, if you could help him get onto some birds, that would be great. That introduction is worth $1 million.
Absolutely. And I cannot echo that loudly enough. And I've lived both of that. Everybody who takes my call thinks I want to go and put it on TV and bring the hordes from all over the country there. And so I have to deal with that in various ways, depending on where some people want that. Other people don't want any of that. And that's fine. I get it. We set up the rules before we go, and we agree to them. So let's say you're part of the club. How do you get kicked out of the club, Dominic?
I think it's these bad behaviors, whether it's bringing the wrong people that go to the bar and piss off all the farmers because they were jerks and they're quote-unquote friends of yours. But I know this from what happens is, you, like this, you're a good example. If you bring anyone, it reflects upon you. The same was if people are hunting with Dominic's crew, Bakken Bay Kennels crew or whatever, and they do anything wrong, it's seen poorly on you. And I've had that happen. If someone in your group breaks a law and gets a ticket, it might as well be you doing it. And so the same is you want to be careful of the company you keep and who you talk to. And I'm so cautious. This thing happens to, I'm sure you, and it happens to me all the time, is that you have a great friend, they're bringing their wife, and then their brother-in-law shows up and he's coming. And I used to just be like, oh, I'll come, everyone come. And it's like, no, I want to know, Have they gotten through hunter safety? Do they actually have a stamp? Do they have, you know, what's their skills and abilities? Do they have a plug in their gun? Are they going to show up with like a turkey choke and we have to shoot steel shot? You know, I mean, I'm much closer at vetting out, you know, do these people know the difference between a Northern Harrier and a pheasant? You know, I mean.
I'm laughing, but you're absolutely right. And perhaps we've all been there to one degree or another, which we might want to remember when we start judging other people as well. But what you're saying, Dominic, is what I've been saying too, I think, and most everybody who we've talked to tonight, and that is you got to get to know each other. You got to understand, respect, and maybe learn a little bit more than we might think before anybody gets the keys to the kingdom.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, maybe I could chat about some ways that I use digital scouting to find new spots.
Good.
So, and I think these are somewhat obvious, but the very first time I saw what was at that time ArcView GIS, a Google Earth, you know, sort of image, I died. I mean, I've loved flying around an airplane since I was young and seeing the world scouting from above, and just the value that that is at our fingertips, especially, you know, like in my area where I live in Harney County, you could zoom in on Google Earth just looking at a certain year and think there's a giant lake there. And that lake may not have had water for 10 years, but you can toggle back to 1991 and back and forth. And you can, I mean, I basically, all my Google Earth scouting for upland bird hunting is all looking for green patches and habitat, you know, look, depending on the species, but it's, you know, more cover for quail, more rocks for chuckers, slopes, you know, all these things. But I can do a ton of it once you know an area, what it looks like from Google Earth from above. And then you are just scouting around on Google Earth. You can find exactly what you're looking for, and it can be really spot on, especially on a good year. You can basically look and be like, that looks like CRP. That's way out in the middle of nowhere. That looks like native range around it. That's good sharp tail country. I bet you that will be a spot that has birds, and you can save some time. We can never save, you know, on the ground looking, you end up getting there and it's all 3-inch tall crested wheatgrass that's grazed over. You can't know that necessarily from the aerial image, but that's the Google Earth is huge.
If you've done that, take us just to the next step, because this is, I think, where most people falter, is that, you know, everybody knows how to use Google Earth now and everybody's comfortable with all of that. Once you find that, though, people are less comfortable with the on the ground part of it.
Yeah, I think so. Well, to kind of two aspects of it, you know, depending on what species you're after. The nice thing is that overlay, as I'm sure you've talked about with tons of other people, Onyx and some other similar products that are out there are such game changers, because they really show what's public land, what's private, and especially what private land is owned by who. So if you get, you know, you get permission on Peterson's place and all of a sudden you're 60 miles away and you see that it's another Peterson place that looks amazing, like that's amazing. You know, that's a huge thing at your fingertips now that is so much easier. But when I'm looking on the landscape, what it is I'm always thinking back to where I have positive experiences. I don't have to be a biologist to know this, is that I think about, okay, where have I seen the most of this species, let's say sharp tails, and I see these certain things. I see this salsify, I see this grass, I see this cover, I see water, I see, you know, a pea field on one side and a wheat field on the other. When I'm driving along, I'm looking for those juxtapositions of those same types of habitats. When I see those things come together, I think this is where I'm going to get out and hunt. And it's the same with quail or pheasants or everything. It's just you base stuff off what you already know. I mean, pheasant hunting is not that hard. You look for a bunch of cattails and a crop field next to it, and you kind of know what that good habitat looks like. But you might not know exactly what a new species, or if you're a brand new hunter, how those things look. So you have to go out and kind of experience it, or go with someone that knows those things, right? You can't just automatically know what good pheasant habitat looks like very easily.
You know, you bring up something that has been, it's been at the back of my mind this whole discussion, and that is, all right, yes, there are people who are lazy and who want you, Dominic, or me, Scott, to just drive them to the spot, walk them to the drop off where the bird is sitting there waiting for them so that they can mount their gun and kill the first bird in the first 100 yards. Okay, those people, they don't count. They're not on my list. They're not on your list. But there are other people who are more than willing to learn and do a lot of the legwork, but they've got, like anybody else, they don't have the confidence quite yet in their abilities, whether it's their ability to find their way back to the truck or their shooting or some other aspect of it, some skill that hasn't been developed yet because they haven't been out there. And I guess I'm editorializing here, but I think there's a difference, and we need to be good at determining which kind of person we're talking with and helping one sort and maybe less helpful for the other sort. Am I onto something there?
Yeah, but I think you mentioned it earlier too, is that, you know, not everybody gets the greatest mentors. I think about where I grew up in Utah, in an era where still, you know, opening day of pheasant and opening day of deer was a big thing in the 90s. I mean, everybody was leaving school on Friday to go for these hunting, but not everybody had the greatest guidance. So a lot of my friends, you know, they had shot birds out of season, or they didn't have the right tags, or they didn't even know about steel shot, like all these things. So not everybody gets the best guidance. And that's why, I mean, a lot of the things that I do now, like I'm really into this, you know, German wirehair pointer breeding, and that you should be breeding only these best dogs or these best dogs. And you see somebody else who's advertising a wild card, you know, just two dogs litter, and you want to jump on them immediately, but you think, you know, the better thing is to try and like chat with them about it, like talk to them about it, like try to be a mentor. And it's the same way for hunting. If you know, I meet people that honestly just don't know any better. They don't know that you're not supposed to shoot hawks because everybody who they ever went hunting with always shot the hawks on their hunting trip because they were bad to pheasants, you know? And so you'd have to do some level of mentorship, and that's a role that is hard to take, but a lot of hunters, I think, are taking that on more and more, and not everybody's had a dad. You know, tons of the hunters that we take out are, you know, learning to hunt in their 30s.
Yeah, like me. That's when I did it. And you're absolutely right. And it's amazing to me when I put this whole concept of this podcast on Facebook on a number of pages. Some pages were loaded with people saying, great idea, I was one of those guys, or I'm doing that for other guys like that now, or girls, or anybody else. Okay, I'm not being misogynistic here. But that was probably the most encouraging thing I got, was how many people are number one, keyed into this, and number two, they understand why they need to be keyed into it, and number three, they're supporting the idea that we need to take these people and mentor them a little bit farther than saying, figure it out for yourself, you lazy whatever, which, by the way, Andy was really vocal about, so... But anyway, that's his problem. I think those kind of people have, you know, they have their own issues. And
I think, you know, the people, well, let's talk about that, I guess. The people that I know, like, I think that, and I don't know if you've ever heard of this person, but there's a guy in Utah, his name's Josh Morris. He's probably the most successful upland hunter in the United States, probably in the world. And you know what? He has a regular job. He's not a biologist. He works all the time. But he kills more Western species and stacks them up and goes to and has the most successful hunts because he is a student. He is a very, very good student. He pays attention to what are the weather patterns in Kansas. Like, we're going to Kansas because weather patterns are looking best they've been in 10 years. And he has Excel charts and notes upon top of notes. And I mean, the students of this game, of figuring it out, knowing the biologist, knowing the biology, knowing the birds, you know, what they want, what they need, what is good for them, what exact timing is good, who to talk to about it. Those students are the ones that I feel like are the most successful at the game consistently. And yeah, if you and I might have, we might have access to a place on the Snake River that consistently has incredible pheasant numbers, and we go there, makes us and our dogs look like a pro. But you can't do that across the nation on public land unless you are a very, very astute student.
You know, your choice of words encourages me a lot, and I'll just relate a quick story. Back when I was a musician, I was not a cellist, but I took a lesson from the number one cellist still living. And I was honored that he would even take me. But I took a lesson, and we got to talking about something, and I said, blah, 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 now you're a teacher, and blah, blah. And he says, no, I'm still a student. And that has stuck with me ever since through four or five other careers. But the idea that, we, number one, we need to be like the grasshopper back in the day. If you're too young for that, well, ask somebody to explain it. But being more of a student and less of a blowhard in itself creates a level of humility that might be really helpful in life in general, but certainly in your hunting life. And that's just my opinion, not Dominic's. Dominic, we could talk all night, but I'm going to turn you loose so you can hopefully get a little rest, and hopefully the rain and the snow and the sleet and all that will stop. And
I've got one quick thing to finish on.
Great.
So let's say we did all this. We did our digital scouting. We did our non-digital scouting. And we found a spot. We found an area. Like, it's 20 miles by 20 miles. So how as a relatively new hunter, how do I find the birds? And this is my sort of spiel on this. There's you know, one way is boot leather. That's the way. You just start walking. But the smarter way, I think, from that is really like going back to being a student, starting with, generally in the early season, it's like finding the water, figuring out what the habitat, read and learn, like what, you know, read, learn, watch YouTube videos, listen to podcasts, read biological reports, and learn about that individual bird and its habitat. And then this is the smartest thing someone's ever told me, is hunt the sign, then hunt the sign. So you're looking for tracks, you're looking for feathers, you're looking for scat. You can't be forever in feathers, tracks, and scat and not eventually come into a bird. So if you find an area with lots of that, you keep hunting that area until you find the birds. And that's sort of my biggest advice is don't waste your time when you're in areas that that have low density, that don't have the birds. And once you find those high density areas, you want to key in on what is it that made that spot special and find more spots like that. And you will cut down your boot leather time significantly.
And I will just echo that 110%, because that's exactly what I was doing when I had an open gun and I was pointing something out on the ground to my hunting partner a week ago Sunday, and the Huns got up 10 yards from us.
Well, as a biologist, it's really hard to shut your mouth sometimes, and I'll...
You mean my mouth?
I can't tell you how many times I'm looking down at the ground going, oh, this looks really good. Oh, there's some diggings right here. And just about then you hear the beeper go off or the GPS on your watch is buzzing, and you're thinking, oh yeah, I'm supposed to be doing this other thing too.
Yeah. Well, it gets worse, you know, because I'm the first guy to look at the camera and say, look at that dog over there. Isn't he... There they go. Oh, well. So Dominic, we do need to do this in person next time. I'm jealous that you're down there. I don't care what it's like. It's probably 30 degrees warmer than your house or my house. So quit your complaining. Good luck. And thanks for being a part of the Upland Nation podcast.
Well, thanks for having me.
I know. Learning something every minute here on the Upland Nation podcast, and that's the whole idea. Got lots more to talk about in this subject area, including a whole bunch of comments from Facebook friends and one Facebook enemy, but you've heard about him already. First off, though, you know, I do this Upland Nation Insights weekly newsletter. You can get it by email. Just sign up at findbirdhuntingspots.com. And one of the things I do, number one, is try to help you find bird hunting spots. Number two, shoot or hunt or train your dog better or something like that. And then I ask you a question every week. And here I'm sharing the most recent poll from that Upland Nation Insights newsletter. And it's kind of selfish, but I'm up against it. You know, I've made this promise to myself and to you all that once the season closes, I'm going to start working really hard on this instinctive shooting style all over again, starting from scratch. And it is working because I talked to you about I mentioned those Huns that got up. I shot a double. But anyway, the question is, if you're shopping for it, are you having trouble finding ammunition? And I know it's kind of a no-duh question, but I felt like I really needed to get a handle on that. And sure enough, we are. Everybody is. 88% of us who are looking for ammo are having trouble finding it. And if you do find it, or if you have a whole bunch, and by the way, thank you. Some of you have already offered to send me some. I could use all the ammo I can get, 20-gauge target loads. I'm going to shoot 1,400 rounds this off-season. Drop me a note, and let's talk. All right, we got This Land Is Your Land coming up right after a few messages here. The first one from Gunner Kennels. No, I think they're just going by gunner.com now because, among other things, they've got accessories for your kennels. They've got all sorts of apparel for you to wear and show your loyalty. Yes, be the first to get early access on all their exclusive offers. They're generally doing something periodically, pricing, etc. Free shipping all the time. Lots of new products out there. Gunner Kennels have been tested and proven to save actual dogs in real accidents. Look at some of the videos. See some of the, you know, the still images out there. Take a look at some of those testing videos and see how tough a Gunner Kennel is. Find out what else they got for you. It's all right there at gunner.com. This Land Is Your Land is brought to you by findbirdhuntingspots.com. Every week, we've got places for you to hunt, plus training and care and feeding of your dog. It's all at findbirdhuntingspots.com. Well, Dominic is down there in Arizona, and I will be too very soon. I will be there too late to hunt this year, but I'm scouting for next year because I got a plan. And one of the places that is high on the list is Lake Havasu. Yeah, London Bridge has fallen down and moved to Arizona. Well, so will we. If you're looking for Gamble's quail, one place to look is around the shores of Lake Havasu. Now, you got to be careful. Some places are closed. Some places are crowded. But the bottom of some of the washes that are open are where I would start if I was down there. Listen for the birds gathering calls first thing in the morning, just like valley quail, gambles. They're related. After morning, they'll hunker in the thick shrubbery and eventually will come out for food and water. If you're feeling too hemmed in by all three of the other hunters in the county, drive southeast to the Bill Williams River's west side. Arizona in the wintertime is like every place else in the summertime. Maybe I'll see you there. Yeah, this topic has elicited an incredible amount of sportsmanlike behavior by a whole bunch of folks on social media. Jeff Anderson is one of those. Jeff says he'd love to take some more new hunters next season. He doesn't want them coming back to the same spots that he took them to unless they've already agreed to that, or at least a courtesy call and make sure that there are no date conflicts with him when he's there. We've all been there on one side or the other of that deal. So that's a good one to remember as well. Wayne Marquardt is lamenting the fact that back in the good old days in Minnesota, it was a sportsman thing to do to give local hunting spots a way to visitors. So we understood back then, or they understood, that number one, hunting is economic development in some of those very small towns. Number two, well, back in the day, most of these hunters had ethics and morals and high values, and they weren't going to do the things that people are continually worried about, and rightly so, these days. That's one thing that Dominic was very, very circumspect about, but you got the idea. Yes, you did. John Triner says, quail, pheasants, sharpies, ruffs all have had similar kind of habitats. Look in the look in the bedrooms that are close to the kitchen. Look for hiding cover and food, and the maximum distance between those two is probably going to be shorter than you think it is, but that's where you should be hunting. Corey Harrison says, for a lot of us, I'm surprised at how unwilling people are to share their knowledge. You're not. Neither am I. Neither is anybody who's been on the podcast today, and probably most people you know. It's really about approaching it appropriately. And Corey reminds us that the more people interested in the sport, the more money and the more advocates, the better conservation, and hopefully, ultimately, more land we all have to hunt on. Yeah, absolutely right. Thank you, Corey, and thank you, everybody else. One more quick reminder, uplandnationdeals.com. If you're looking to get shed of some of the stuff that's gathering dust in your garage, or if you're looking to upgrade your equipment, pro-level gear at entry-level prices will help you get rid of the stuff you don't want and get a hold of the stuff you do want. It's all at uplandnationdeals.com. Well, the name of this little tune is A Day to Remember, and it has been a day to remember. I have learned so much, and I am humbled again by your willingness out there, number one, to share your advice, and number two, to help out new hunters in one way or another. Thank you so much. If you like the podcast, tell your friends. Go to Upland Nation on Apple Podcasts and rate or review it, please. Thank you for recent reviews from A Real Bird Hunter Who Cares and Grubbin. That was like a Hobbit character. Our quote this week comes from Anne-Louise Germaine de Stael-Holstein. Of course, to you and me, she's known as Madame de Stael. She says, "The more I see of man, the more I like dogs." Danke schön, Madame de Stael. And to you all for listening, I'm Scott Linden. Thank you so much. Be safe. Take a new hunter. See you in the field.